This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Dr. Gerald Horn, who is possibly the most prolific Black scholar in the country, has published yet another book, this one on how the Haitian Revolution affected world history. And Black farmers in the United States and in Honduras are recognized for promoting food sovereignty. But first, a conference on the Black radical tradition is scheduled for January 8th through 10th at Philadelphia's Temple University. Dr. Anthony Montero, who was until recently a professor of African American studies at Temple, is one of the conference organizers. Dr. Montero says it's time for the Black liberation movement to get focused.
You know, we're in the throes of an emerging and intensifying movement that is proliferating. The most visible part of the movement is the anti-police state violence, but it includes the struggle for schools, the struggle for jobs, the struggles against gentrification. So we have this proliferating set of movements without yet a clear vision or ideology. And what we hope to do at the conference on the Black radical tradition is to help to develop a vision of the future and an ideology about what the fight is and where to target, ultimately to target the fight.
Well, what is the Black radical tradition? And I don't think that's a naive question, in that I doubt that many people could define the Black radical tradition or even recognize that there is one.
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. And that's part of what we intend to do at the conference, to define just what this tradition is. In many ways, it begins in the anti-slavery struggle, probably with Black abolitionism, Henry Highland Garnett, Mariah Stewart, Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass, and it continues in the post-slavery struggle, especially with those men and women who were fighting for democracy and for Black Reconstruction between 1865 and maybe 1880. Some of them were elected to the Congress and to the Senate and to state houses. Others were responsible for establishing public schools. And then by the 1890s, we have, I think, the crystallization of what we could call the modern Black radical tradition, with people like Anna Julia Cooper, Ida B. Wells Barnett, Alexander Crummell, and of course, probably the most important figure in this whole tradition, W.E.B. Du Bois. And as we move into the 20th century, the Black radical tradition becomes part of the socialist movement, but also of the anti-war, anti-World War I movement, the anti-colonial movements, and after the Russian Revolution, the Black radical tradition gravitates towards solidarity with the Russian Revolution. Many of the outstanding figures of the Black radical tradition of that time become communist and Marxist. And this only intensifies with the Great Depression. And then we get post-World War II and McCarthyism and the attempt to crush the Black radical tradition, both in its theorizing and its activism. But then it emerges again with the Civil Rights Movement. And as we follow the trajectory of the Civil Rights Movement, both in people like Martin Luther King Jr., but also in people like Mamie Till Mobley, the mother of Emmett Till, who takes this profound stance against the murder of her son and stands as a figure in my mind in the Black radical tradition from the standpoint of her militant stance against the lynching of her son in Mississippi. And her stance was so outstanding that it inspired Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott movement of the 1950s. But then, of course, Malcolm X emerges, Martin Luther King evolves into a figure that opposes capitalism and war and racism. Malcolm X is this exemplary figure in revolutionary Black nationalism. And then it continues with the Black Panther Party, Huey P. Newton, and so on. And of course, up till today, where we see this movement emerging that, if it continues, has nowhere to go except to take up the trajectory that was begun by earlier movements, which means in effect, opposition to capitalism, white supremacy, and U.S. empire.
When we speak of the people and the movements that you just mentioned, who are part of the Black radical tradition, we should also talk about those historically who have not been part of that tradition, who've been part of what might have been called the Black accommodationist tradition of Booker T. Washington and such, and that tradition also continues to this day.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And it continues in the form of what you all at Black Agenda Report have defined as the Blackness leadership class. And this group, which emerges after the civil rights movement, kind of crystallized as a bourgeois class strata of the Black community, who become a buffer between the masses of working and poor Black people and the white ruling elite. And in fact, not just a buffer, but apologist for them. And at the same time, are constituted as a parasitic growth upon the Black community. They do not engage in any kind of productive work, but benefit mightily from their administrative, almost neo-colonial role in relationship to Black people. But in a way, they go back to Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington, however, was never as bad as most of these are.
So there's nothing strange, nothing ahistorical about Black folks arguing with each other and splitting into different camps politically. Those who consider themselves heirs to the Black radical tradition and others.
You're right. There's always been this attempt on the part of both reactionary cultural nationalists and petty bourgeois reformists and apologists to say that we're all Black people. Why should we divide ourselves along class and ideological lines? And then when they say that, they're pointing the finger at those who are critical of their politics and of their ideology. But the response must be that it is not the critics of the accommodationist positions, be they from the standpoint of reactionary nationalism or petty bourgeois reformism. We did not create the class division. We did not create the politics of accommodation. We only pursue a principled politics of going to the people in order to encourage and to foment militant resistance. What the apologists seek to do is to weaken any efforts at militant resistance to white supremacy and the economic crisis that is thrust upon ordinary Black folk.
The apologists within the black community seem to have the upper hand nowadays. We don't hear much about imperialism and class in the black political conversation these days.
Yeah, they do have an upper hand, and they will always have a relative upper hand because of their connections to the centers of white power in the country. The apologists can only continue to be prominent and really to exist, not because they are autonomous and dependent upon the black community for their existence, but because they are dependent upon the centers of white capitalist power. And for that reason, they behave as middlemen and as apologists for the very system that is oppressing the majority of their own people. But in times like this, new possibilities open up. And what we see, especially among young people, and especially among that vanguard of activists, a urge towards something different, to a higher level of struggle. And those are the people that we're trying to address in this conference.
As you observe the new crop of activists, is it your assessment that there is a conscious effort on their part to follow in the black radical tradition, to measure their works by that of icons such as Dr. King and Malcolm X and Du Bois and others?
There's no doubt in my mind that that exists. Clearly, the commercial media wants to diminish the significance of that among the young generation. But I believe that that is the majority tendency. You know, what I see is the emergence of political and ideological tendencies among this generation, not unlike the tendencies that produce the Black Panther Party, that produce the stage of Martin Luther King's evolution, of his uniting war, racism, and economic exploitation as triple evils. I see the same thing among this generation of youth. And I also see that element that is very similar to the young people who went into the South in the 1960s, you know, young people in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Congress of Racial Equality, who went down South on freedom rides, on lunch counter sit-ins, on voting registration drives, and put their bodies on the line. This element is not the element that you see creating hashtags. This is a whole different element. These are not connected to foundations and other external agencies of funding for the black community. This group, unlike the young SNCC and CORE activists, are really anti-capitalist. And they are not interested in a discussion about change that does not include a change in the economic system, as well as a change that totally brings down the system of white supremacy.
And yet the tendency, the current towards accommodation is evident today.
Oh, no question about it. It's very evident. But in my interaction with students and non-student young people, they have very little, if any, respect for the accommodationist in their generation. Most of them are really not fooled by them and are seeking a different path, a path not of being apologists or even celebrities that are to be found on CNN or MSNBC or are upheld by the editorial pages of the New York Times or the Democratic Party National Committee. I mean, the real driving forces, be they in Ferguson or Baltimore or Philadelphia or Oakland or Chicago of this movement want nothing to do with the establishment, or they don't seek legitimation from the establishment.
Is this multi-generational range of activism going to be reflected in the conference at Temple in January?
Oh, most definitely so. I mean, it's going to be, I think, something very historic. There will be that generation of Angela Davis, of Cornel West, of Robin Kelly, but then there'll be that generation of academics like Stephen Salata and Vijay Prashad. But there'll also be people like Alicia Garza and Charlene Carruthers. But then there'll be people whose names we don't actually know. The students from Students for Justice in Palestine, students from the various Black Students Unions around Philadelphia at Temple and from universities up and down the East Coast, but also youth coming out of the churches and out of the labor unions and out of the streets, the unemployed, the impoverished youth. So I think we're going to get that cross-section, and it will be multi-generational, but it will be focused upon a vision of a future that is different from what we are living now.
Every epoch has its own particular contradictions and conditions, and from that come demands. What do you think the demands that you'll see being articulated at this conference might be?
I think they're really going to be radical demands. I think we're not just going to talk about minor reforms in policing. I think people are going to talk about community control and the undermining or destruction of the structures and institutions of police power in the Black community today. I think people are going to talk about something wholly different. I think we will be addressing the issue of American empire and war and enduring or unending wars and dangerous wars with provocations against China and Russia. I think this question of U.S. empire and military bases is going to be addressed. But certainly the questions of joblessness and the destruction of public education. In fact, the first day of the conference will start with a march entitled A March for Our Future that'll be led by a coalition of young people and students, high school and college students, and young people who are unemployed, who will march on the Philadelphia School Board and protest against the closing down of public education and replacing it with charter schools. We will have on the second day of the conference a march against gentrification, and we will target in particular Temple University and this plan to build a football stadium, a $100 million, 40,000 seat football stadium in the middle of Black North Philadelphia, which will change the character of North Philadelphia from a community to I don't know what. So this will not only be a conference about activism, but will be a conference that will include activism. And it will, in this whole context, attempt to come up with a radical consensus that will inform a vision of the future and will thereby suggest strategies and tactics on local levels of fighting for this future.
Dr. Anthony Montero, speaking from Philadelphia. Dr. Gerald Horn, the professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, is one of the most prolific Black scholars of modern times. Much of his recent work has focused on the origins of the United States as a bulwark of slavery and racist reaction. Dr. Horn's new book is titled Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. Horn sees his book as an update on the late, great C.L.R. James's 1938 classic, The Black Jacobins, Toussaint L'Ouverture and the San Domingo Revolution.
Certainly, this book is an homage to the C.L.R. James book from the 1930s, but in some senses it's also an updating. I mean, the way history works, as you well know, is that as time passes, historians come up with new interpretations, and they oftentimes come up with new interpretations based upon new evidence. And to the extent that history purports to be in the scientific mode, well, this is the way generally that science works. That is to say, as time passes, there's updating based upon asking new questions and coming up with new evidence. Now, my book, Confronting Black Jacobins, the United States, Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, deals not only, like James's book, with the 1791 to 1804 revolutionary process that eventuates on January 1st, 1804, and the triumph of the first successful revolt of the enslaved, perhaps globally, certainly in the Americas. But unlike James's work, my work focuses on the role of the United States. In some senses, my current work is a sequel to my book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. My book was a break with the consensus of left, right, and center, which had posited that the revolt against British rule in North America in 1776 was a great leap forward for humanity. I disagreed in my book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, and suggested that the revolt against British rule was actually a counter-revolution driven by the fear that London would abolish slavery, thereby jeopardizing the fortunes of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, James Madison, et al. I posited that the revolt against British rule was akin to the revolt against British rule in what was then Rhodesia in November 1965, that led to the formation of Zimbabwe, where the Rhodesians thought that Britain was moving towards African majority rule, and rather than have that occur and have their fortunes thereby jeopardized, which of course we saw when much of their land was expropriated after the formation of Zimbabwe, they revolted and set up a white minority regime. So my Haitian Revolution book is a continuation of 1776 because in order to become victorious in 1776 against the mighty British Empire, the ragtag rebels on the North American mainland relied heavily upon assistance from France. France went into debt in order to strike a blow against its antagonists across the channel in London and help the rebels in North America become victorious by supplying them with materiel of all sorts. But that maneuver by Paris helped to engender a crisis, that is to say, the deep debt that Paris went into in order to finance the rebels in the North American mainland. And that crisis led to the French Revolution, 1789, which in turn let loose trends that were to come back to haunt the North American mainland. What I mean is that the triumph of the rebels was in many ways a triumph of slave trade. In my book on Cuba, I noted that after the triumph of the United States of America in 1776, the North Americans, the U.S. nationals, supplanted the Spanish in terms of bringing Africans to Cuba. After they triumphed in 1776, they also began flooding Hispaniola. That is to say, the island that the Haitian Revolution took place on, with enslaved Africans. This tipped the demographic balance against the European settlers. Sometimes they were outnumbered at rates to 30 to 1 at a time that they were shamelessly, mercilessly, and cruelly exploiting African and slave labor. This was a combustible brew that erupted in August 1791 when the first blows were struck that led to the ouster of the settlers, French and U.S. nationals, too, own plantations on Hispaniola, establishing the revolutionary process that eventuated in the Haitian Revolution. Now, as the revolutionary process in France was radicalizing, there were steps taken towards abolition of slavery in any case, and that helped to put gust of wind in the sails of the Africans in Hispaniola. And you see retrospectively that there was a symbiotic relationship between the two revolutionary processes in Hispaniola and in France. Now, the problem in France, of course, is that the revolutionary fervor ultimately was snuffed out by the rise of Napoleon Bonaparte, who then sought to crush the Haitian Revolution, what came to be called the Haitian Revolution. But instead, he was crushed. That is to say, the French were not victorious in seeking to crush the Haitian Revolution. Not only did the French take a beat down in Hispaniola, but the mighty British Empire also sought to crush the Haitian Revolution, fearing, understandably and justifiably, that if the Africans triumphed on Hispaniola, they would then be looking to Jamaica, which turned out to be true, because, of course, there were Jamaicans, black Jamaicans, who were involved in the Haitian revolutionary process from day one. But what happened was that London also suffered one of the most staggering and significant blows ever inflicted upon the British Empire. And, of course, the Spanish took their beat down as well. What this led to, of course, was that the United States, in the early stages, its thrust was to see the strategic objective as ousting France from the hemisphere. And so that led to an early entente with the African leaders led by Toussaint Louverture. But of course, it was not only their strategic objective to see France ousted from the hemisphere, which happened and of course led to the so-called Louisiana Purchase, that is to say, Paris and the United States collaborating and colluding to take land that didn't belong to neither one of them, it belonged to the indigenous people, but title was transferred improperly to the United States, increasing the territorial expanse of the United States by an order of magnitude. The United States then stretching from the northern reaches of the Canadian border down to New Orleans. And this, of course, was a great victory for the United States of America. But you should also know that the United States of America also feared that the Haitian military, the revolutionary military under Toussaint Louverture, would seek to take the battle to Dixie. And keep in mind that the U.S. president in the 1790s, one George Washington, the number of troops he commanded during his conflict with London was exceeded by the number of troops that Toussaint Louverture commanded in the late 1790s. And so this led to the United States under George Washington being very concerned about the thrust of the Haitian Revolution. In any case, after Britain received its appropriate beatdown, it came to its senses and began moving towards abolition of slavery. In fact, my major thesis in this book is that you cannot understand the abolition of slavery in the Americas, including the United States of America, without understanding the fact that the Haitian Revolution ignited a general crisis of the entire slave system that could only be resolved with its collapse. That is to say that the Haitian Revolution compelled Britain to move towards the abolition of slave trade, circa 1807, the abolition of slavery in the 1830s. Then both Britain and Haiti put pressure on the United States. Haiti in particular, if you look at the major slave revolts in North America, Gabriel Prosser or Gabriel's revolt circa 1800 in Virginia, Denmark Vesey's circa 1821 in South Carolina, Nat Turner circa 1831 in Virginia, they all have Haitian fingerprints all over them. You can say the same for a number of revolts that are taking place in the hemisphere, particularly in Barbados, Puerto Rico, etc. So Britain reads the tea leaves and decides that with the rise of Haiti, a new situation has come into being and that the planter class could not only lose the institution of slavery, they could ultimately lose their lives. Because a contemporary U.S. historian has argued, and I don't agree with this, but I'll report it anyway, that the Haitian Revolution led to a genocide against Europeans on the island of Hispaniola, which was something that was believed at the time, which obviously put fear and loathing into the very marrow of the bones of slave owners in the United States of America, who then, of course, saw it as their sacred mission to try to overthrow the Haitian Revolution. Now, step back for a minute and let me refocus on this question that you can't understand the abolition of slavery in the United States without understanding the Haitian Revolution and the process it helped to ignite, because even our left-wing historians, so-called, in many ways have signed on to a so-called American exceptionalist program. That is to say, they tend to look at the United States as a thing in itself. They analyze the abolition of slavery only by looking at internal factors, which tends to overestimate the depth of progressive sentiment, particularly amongst the Euro-American population. And I dare say that that overestimation is still plaguing the U.S. left to this very day. By way of comparison, if you look at Southern Africa, I'm working on a new book on the coming to African majority rule in South Africa, which is a companion volume to my earlier book on the coming to African majority rule in what is now Zimbabwe. But if you look at South Africa, for example, it's clear that the internal forces on the ground in South Africa played a key and strategic role in the retreat of apartheid. But we also know that the frontline states, particularly Angola, played a key role. We know that the Cuban troops who defeated the apartheid army at the Battle of Cuitacuna Valley in southern Angola in 1988 and were threatening to march all the way to Pretoria to oust forcibly the apartheid rulers from power, they played a key role in the liberation of South Africa. We know that the socialist countries and the Soviet Union and East Germany at the time, they trained the militants of the armed wing of the African National Congress. We know that when ANC, African National Congress President Oliver Tambo, was ill, that he was receiving medical care in Stockholm, Sweden. We know about the anti-apartheid movement in the United States of America that rocked this nation from the Atlantic to the Pacific out to Hawaii. And all of this played a role in the retreat of apartheid. But yet, when we talk about United States slavery, we act as if it was only an internal process, which is worse than silliness. It's actually a very dangerous idea.
Yes, and in fact, many historians have treated Britain as if it had some kind of exceptionalism, that its move towards abolition of slavery was caused primarily by internal factors of enlightenment among the British polity, rather than shock and fear at the trifecta won by the people of Haiti against the French, the Spanish, and the British.
Well, you know, there's an old saying that there's nothing like the prospect of being executed in the morning for concentrating the mind wonderfully. And certainly the British planter class in the Caribbean faced the dire prospect of being executed. And it's amazing what that can do to help to clear the sinuses and the mind and help people to think more clearly and realistically. And that is what drove Britain towards abolition. The fact that they would lose their property, and perhaps less important, they would lose their lives. So once this revolutionary process triumphed, you then begin to see the fear and loathing manifest in North America in terms of repeated efforts to overthrow the revolutionary process in Haiti. But at the same time, this revolutionary process was very encouraging, to put it mildly, to the enslaved Africans on the North American mainland. It showed that they could fight and win, and it helped to invigorate them and help them to struggle on. But you should also know that a number of so-called free Negroes from North America, from the United States, decided to throw in their lot with Haiti. It's estimated by the 1820s, maybe 13,000 minimally of this class of so-called free Negroes had migrated to Haiti. This was very timely, because keep in mind that at the triumph of the Haitian Revolution, 1804, the revolutionaries controlled the western side of the island. Of what was to become the Dominican Republic was controlled by Spain to that time, and there was a battle royal to oust Spain from the eastern side of the island, which comes to success in the 1820s. And at that time, the Haitian leadership decides that the better part of wisdom would be to invite the so-called free Negroes there to populate the eastern sector of the island, because they would be their allies against those who had formerly sworn allegiance to Madrid. And of course, those who had formerly sworn allegiance to Madrid, they too were miffed, if not terrified, by the coming to power on the eastern side of the island of the Haitians, because, of course, one of the first things they did was to abolish slavery. And so you saw this steady stream of former free Negroes to the Caribbean, to Hispaniola, some of them, of course, assuming high office in the Haitian government, which I detail in the book. But what happens is that the empire strikes back. That is to say that in 1844, the United States helps to engineer the secession of what is now the Dominican Republic from Haiti. And let me say that I respect Dominican sovereignty in 2015. I'm not trying to call prospectively for the liquidation of the sovereignty of the Dominican Republic. But I do think that this history needs to be better known because it sheds light on the current crisis between Haiti and the Dominican Republic that has led to the DR seeking to expel many dark-skinned nationals who were actually born in the DR but are set to be Haitian. And that, of course, is a continuation of a pattern that the U.S. authorities helped to engineer going back to 1844 in one of the first successful covert actions of the U.S. State Department when they engineered the secession. Now, to step back for a second, once again, as we look with a broader lens, we see now, retrospectively, I hope, that in 1776, there was a secessionist revolt against London that led to the United States of America. In 1836, there was a secessionist revolt against Mexico that led to the establishment of the so-called Republic of Texas as an independent nation. Then, of course, it was swallowed up by the United States in 1845, not least because independent Texas could not withstand the hammer blows inflicted upon it by abolitionist London and, of course, abolitionist Haiti. In 1844, of course, there was the secessionist regime established in the Dominican Republic. What's interesting is that by 1860, as the DR was too being pulverized by the Haitian military, in a remarkable gesture, the DR government asked for the Spanish colonizers to come back and recolonize the DR. I mean, usually nations resist colonialism, not invite it, but that shows you the lengths and depths to which the regime in the DR had sunk because of its fear and fright of Haiti. But what's striking, of course, is that there were a number of Dominicans who, of course, fought against this recolonization. They linked arms with their Haitian brothers and sisters across the border and drove out the Spanish. But at the same time, what was happening was that the U.S. Civil War was coming into being, circa 1861. And at that time, you may know that there was a split in London as to the position to be taken on the U.S. Civil War. On the one hand, there was strong abolitionist sentiment in London, particularly amongst the working class. But on the other hand, amongst the elite, perhaps understandably, there was a felt desire to see the split of this powerful rival, the United States of America, into two nations, which would have weakened this rival. And of course, I should also mention that there were forces in London, too, who were pro-slavery and had not given up the demented dream of having slavery returned. Because keep in mind that throughout a good deal of the 19th century, even though slavery was being abolished in many different precincts, including Haiti, there was still a felt desire to see this institution come back. That was the import, in fact, of the establishment of the DR in 1844. The next step was to use the DR as a launching pad from which U.S. slave owners could re-enslave black people in Haiti. And in fact, during the U.S. Civil War, you saw this slave-owning regime set up in the so-called Confederate States of America. And one of the first things that happened after that regime was established was they began to send so-called slave ships into Haitian territorial waters, trying to kidnap Haitians and bring them to Texas and Louisiana and Mississippi to work as enslaved people. And of course, this outraged and enraged the Haitians. And the United States, of course, that is to say the so-called U.S. of A. headed by Abraham Lincoln, came to realize that one of the few true allies that they had on the abolitionist front was Haiti. Because as noted, Britain was split, France was split, Spain was split. The United States found that its only true ally on terms of beating back the slave-owning Confederate States of America was Haiti. But of course, no good deed goes unpunished. And so after the U.S. Civil War is consummated with a defeat, thankfully, of the so-called Confederate States of America, the United States then moves to try to annex the entire island of Hispaniola, Haiti and DR alike, and then deport a good deal of the newly freed, formerly enslaved population of the United States. That is to say, you know, people like myself, or let us say our ancestors, and deport us all to Hispaniola. This was debated in the U.S. Senate, and it barely was defeated. I mean, it's only a matter of accident and happenstance that we are now talking on the North American mainland in English as opposed to being in Hispaniola conversing in either Creole, French, or Spanish. And that is basically where my book concludes, that is to say, with the failed attempt to annex the entire island and deport us all there. But of course, we know that the saga and the struggle continues. We know about the U.S. effort to occupy the island circa 1915, that is to say, both Haiti and the Dominican Republic ousted from Haiti's circa 1934. We know about the guerrilla war that erupted in Haiti to oust the occupiers from that land. We know, fast forwarding to today, about the impact of the Haitian earthquake circa 2010 and the fact that, as is typical of our community, how we stepped up to send funds to Haiti, much of which was expropriated and appropriated by sticky fingers in the U.S. Red Cross and elsewhere, not to mention the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation, who have set themselves up as a kind of viceroy on the island. We know about the electoral struggles that are still unfolding in the Republic of Haiti. And we, of course, know about what I mentioned a moment ago, about the conflict between Haiti and the DR that has led the latter nation, the DR, to seek to expel people that they consider to be Haitians, which also has led the regime in Santo Domingo to castigate the famed Dominican writer who lives in the United States, Junot Diaz, because he stood with the Haitians and he had received an order of merit from the DR that was just, as I understand it, revoked because of his staunch position against bigotry and racism, a kind of bigotry and racism that I'm afraid still afflicts a good deal of the DR, but which stretches back, of course, to conflicts that in no small measure were engineered by the U.S. State Department in 1844.
And we know of that perversion in that the Dominican Republic's most popular holiday is not its independence from Spain, which was initiated by the Haitians, but the end of what they call the Haitian occupation, its independence from Haiti in 1844.
It's very unfortunate. And I think, obviously, progressive forces in the North American mainland need to be pushing for concord between Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Obviously, it's going to be very difficult as long as this kind of racial chauvinism persists in certain sectors in Santo Domingo, manifested most dramatically, you may recall, when the Dominican baseball slugger Sammy Sosa, who of course was accused of taking performance-enhancing drugs, but nonetheless socked over 600 home runs, but after he retired, this brown-skinned man began to lose the melanin in his face, and it was charged credibly that this was not an episode of vitiligo where your melanin disappears, whether you like it or not. It was a process engineered by himself. And in some senses, that's a metaphor for a certain elite within the DR, because as we approach the so-called Baseball World Series, where you will see once again a number of Dominican stars on the diamond. They play a disproportionate role in the sport. And what's happened, of course, is that many of these pitchers and sluggers return to the DR rather affluent, to put it mildly, because at their height, some of these baseball players are making in the double digits, in the millions per year. But also they return not only with fortunes, they oftentimes return with these rather polluted ideas with regard to race and racism from the United States of America that are then buttressed by their newly minted class status. And it's creating a very difficult situation that we all must approach both diplomatically and tactfully.
Dr. Gerald Horn, speaking from Houston. Two black farmers' organizations, one in the U.S. Deep South, the other in Central America, have been awarded the 2015 Food Sovereignty Prize. But what is food sovereignty? We asked Beverly Bell, coordinator of Other Worlds and an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington.
Food sovereignty goes beyond food security, which says that everyone has the right to adequate food, quality food, and food on time, that is when they're hungry, but can also involve dumping, for example, of U.S. agribusiness foods that are subsidized by our tax dollars and put farmers out of business all over the world. Food sovereignty also goes beyond food justice, which is about local production and often looks at the structural racism involved in food sovereignty. Food justice looks at local production and considers the patterns of structural racism in our food systems. However, food sovereignty is a much more expansive concept and looks at global systems of food and considers the right to eat, the right of farmers to produce, the right of people to live on their lands, the right of people to control their riches of nature, that is including, for example, the water that they need to irrigate, so their rivers, often their ancestral rivers, and also trade policies and other global policies that often completely imperil the production and agricultural systems of especially low-income countries around the world.
It sounds as if food sovereignty means fulfilling folks' right to self-determination. That is, sovereignty in food allows people to be self-determining in their lives.
You said it exactly right in the most simple way possible, because when we look at food, what's underneath it? It is who controls the economy, who controls the systems of production, who controls the systems of distribution, who controls the power of land, that is, who gets to live on the land, who gets to own the land, who gets to work the land, who controls native territories. Is it actually the native people who have say over what's happening on their land? Often, of course, we know it's not. It's about who gets access to the food itself. So, of course, we live in a land of obesity, and as we know, many people around the world starve. So food touches everything.
There used to be a lot of black farmers in the South. In fact, black farmers were almost as well represented as blacks were in the population, but no more.
No more. There is less than 1% of agricultural land now controlled by black farmers. And as you mentioned, this did not used to be the case. There has been a huge drop-off, and it has to do with all of the ways that racism play out in the society, again, from those same structural patterns we just spoke about of who gets to control the land and the local economy. But also, black farmers have had to deal with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which is sometimes called the last plantation, and which has been found by courts of law to have systematically enacted racist policies which have been prejudicial against both the farming and the land control of black farmers. And so one thing that we love about the Federation of Southern Cooperatives is that they are fighting back and they are working to sustain land ownership by black farmers throughout the whole Deep South, from South Carolina all the way to Texas.
How has the Federation helped black farmers keep their heads above water?
Well, the first thing to note is that the Federation, in fact, was formed in 1967, right up there in the peak years of the Civil Rights Movement, and it was formed by the five main civil rights organizations who knew that it was not just enough to have political and social rights if you are without land or home or food. So they created the Federation of Southern Cooperatives to be an economic arm of the Civil Rights Movement. And so the Federation is today more than 30 farmers' co-ops across 13 states in the Deep South, and they have fought politically, that is, they fought to change laws that have made it harder for them to hold their lands. They have helped each other with production and marketing, knowing that farming, of course, is a terribly difficult business, but that together they can help each other. They have gained publicity for the issue and some of the problems behind it. They have actually changed the course of farming history in the U.S. by bringing two enormous lawsuits to the national level. They are known together as Pigford for the name of one of the plaintiffs. This was a class action lawsuit by black farmers against the theft of their land and injustice by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and they actually won. And the second lawsuit then turned into a piece of legislation that Obama signed at the beginning of his presidency that has given protections to black farmers. So it's very, very difficult. It's quite an uphill battle, as you can imagine, but they are really holding the flag and saying that black farmers' lives matter and that they deserve the same justice as all other farmers.
It should be noted that in the late 1800s and into the early 1900s, black farmers' organizations, comprised of black landowners and tenant farmers and sometimes farm workers, were a powerful political influence in the black South, but were violently suppressed.
That's right. In the days when so many white folk had led a backlash against some of the ascendancy of African Americans who had been enslaved. And it's interesting to note that some of these farmers still actually hold the title to their homestead plots, that is 164 acres, that were given to them just after enslavement. So, for instance, Ben Burkett, whom I wish could be speaking with you instead of me, he is a powerful, powerful voice and activist from Mississippi, of course a farmer himself. He still has on his wall the title to his great-great-grandfather's land that was given to him after he was freed from slavery, and it is signed by Grover Cleveland. So there was at one point a brief moment in this country that justice had to be done for people who had been enslaved, but now their ancestors have lost that right.
Black people in Honduras and indigenous people are looking for that bright moment in the sun as well.
That's right. The second winner of this award is another black group. They are Afro-Indigenous peoples. They are a mixture of descendants of formerly enslaved people as well as Garifuna indigenous peoples, and they live on the Atlantic coast of Honduras. The organization that won the prize is called the Black Fraternal Organization of Honduras, or OFRANE by its Spanish acronym, and they compose 46 communities up and down this area. And just as we spoke about with black farmers in the Deep South of the U.S., these people have had their land stolen from them by multinational corporations that want to put in crops for agrofuel, biofuel, and they have had their lands stolen by narco traffickers as well as by tourism concessions, because their land is beautiful beachfront and they are fighting right now for their oceanfront and their waters, the ocean and the rivers themselves, to stay in their hands. But they are fierce as can be, and they have used advocacy both in the streets, that is demonstrations, protests, as well as in the halls of their Congress in Honduras. They have raised their voice, and just like the black farmers of the Federation of Southern Cooperatives that we have spoken about, they are also using the legal arena, and they are the third indigenous people ever in the Americas to take an international claim to court. And we expect a ruling very soon from the Inter-American Court of Human Rights saying that all of this development on their land was taking place without the legally mandated free, prior, and informed consent of their lands and waters.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.